This is such an honor to be able to introduce Steve, who has become such a dear friend. And as I shared earlier, I met Steve a little over 2 years ago at a service-based gathering at Wildlife Associates, which is a wildlife sanctuary with over 50 non-releasable animals, wild animals, that Steve founded in Northern California about 34 years ago. And as with Bragash, I think we were probably in the same circle. It was the first time that I experienced really connecting to a wild animal without using our eyes, you know, taking that primary sense away. And it was a beautiful experience when Steve instructed all of us to close our eyes and drop our energy down and low and extend it out, so kind of in the heart area, and then extend it out about 4 feet. And then he introduced us to his animal caregiver, Michelle, who brought a wild animal around the circle, and she would stop for a few seconds in front of each of us. Again, our eyes were closed. And he taught us to rely on our inner knowing and our intuitive abilities to sense what animal was with us. And what was extraordinary to me was that I could tell the size of the animal. I could tell if it was fur or feathers. And I could even feel this loving energy coming from an opossum. And that day I was just hooked. I was just, you know, so for more than 40 years, Steve has introduced hundreds of thousands of children and adults to the wonders of science and nature. And his work has brought him into school assembly programs where animals travel as teachers, to hands-on programs at the wildlife sanctuary where he brings in at-risk children and young adults to learn to trust and heal through the backstories of these animals and the presence of the animals. Steve is a visionary and has pioneered a methodology for teaching us to reconnect to our inner teacher and to fall in love with life and all its mystery. And what we will learn from Steve is a methodology he has created from a lifetime of living and being with animals. And we can all access our wild nature. His first teachers were two robins living in a tree next door to his childhood home. And from the age of 9, he knew or was given his path. His greatest teacher was a 300-pound American black bear named Susie Bear, who continues to teach him lessons he didn't quite understand while she was living. And about 6 years ago, Steve was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, a debilitating disease that affects the neurological pathways of the brain. And the symptoms can be really severe at times, where Steve can sometimes only access, you know, like 10% of his consciousness. So it's changed his day-to-day living and his routine incredibly. He can no longer work with many of the animals. But the disease has become another kind of teacher for Steve. And his devoted meditation practice for decades and decades has been a constant anchor. And sometimes focusing on his breathing is all he can do. What makes him come alive is his teaching. And over the past 2 years, he has spearheaded an amazing expansion of the sanctuary's programs. And I thought it was wonderful when he was creating his new business cards. He refers himself to as founder and storyteller. And, you know, as he's taught me with Steve, I typically fall into silence with him, because being with him is such a powerful experience. And his stories are just spellbinding. So it's a pleasure to introduce you, Steve. And I just wanted to, I'm going to let you share the quote with Mark Twain that you shared with me yesterday, because it's something that really touched me. But thank you so much for being on the call today, Steve.
Well, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for being here and for definitely giving me the opportunity and sharing ability and the platform in which to teach, because that's what I need to do in my life. That's what gives me sustenance in this life.
And Steve, maybe you can share a little about your early life and a few pivotal moments that led you to devote your life to wild animals.
As a very young child, I was always testing the world. I knew that there was something out there that wasn't being shown to me, that wasn't being told to me, and there was some sort of secret lingering around the corners of reality. And I'm talking about when I was like 5 or 6, when we used to go to department stores with my mother and father, I used to, as soon as we walked outside, I would run back in as fast as I could and just look. And my parents thought I was a little strange, but they thought I would grow out of it. And every time I would run back in, and they never really knew what I was doing. But I thought it was so weird that I lived on a planet where all you do is either sell something or buy something, that couldn't be real, that the people, something had to be tricking me. So I thought if I ran back in the store, I would see people frozen or nobody would be there because it didn't seem to be the reality of existence to me as a 5 or 6 year old kid. And I never caught them, but I never said I was wrong. I always said I wasn't fast enough. And so I kept doing it. And at some point I stopped because I started looking other places for the bits of reality. In second grade, I remember looking out the window of the school, of the classroom, and it was an amazing snowstorm that was going on. I was looking at all the snowflakes going down by me, and the teacher said, "Steve, will you pay attention?" And I looked at her and I said, "I am paying attention." And I wasn't trying to be a wise mouth, but I was really paying attention to the snow. And she goes, "Okay, I'll let you look at the snow for a couple minutes, and then you come back to class." And I kept looking out the window. She goes, "Okay, Steve, if you've seen one snowflake, you've seen them all." And I stood up because I just saw something on TV the night before, and I wanted to share with the teacher in the class. And I said, "No, really, every single one of those snowflakes is different. It's different." And she sent me to the principal. In my heart, I was just connecting to the joy of realizing that every snowflake had a different crystalline form, and just the beauty of everything in nature was just overwhelming me, and it just grabbed my attention more than what was going on in the classroom. And I remember, as you mentioned, the backyard was an open lot with some trees in it, and that became my wilderness area, even though it was in the middle of the suburbs. Even though it was probably only 60 by 40 feet or whatever the size of a lot is at that time, I knew every insect, every plant, every bird that flew by, every raccoon and opossum that came over at nighttime. And I would catalog them in my head, and they all became my friends and my place for living. And these two birds, these two robins one year, started to become my friends. They started to get closer and closer to me. As I was climbing the trees and hanging by my favorite branch, they decided to build a nest within 3 feet of where I would sit every day. That was my lookout. And I watched them build a nest. I would run home from school, and I caught them laying the last of three eggs. And I would run home from school and just to catch them hatching out of the eggs and watching the mother feed them. And one day, the mother and father, who normally take turns finding food and taking care of the babies, because they always leave one there to protect the babies, they left me to protect the babies. And I knew what was going on, and my eyes started to tear up, because I realized they trust me so much to protect their babies. And one day I was just so excited, and I ran home from school, and I heard a big noise of some sort of a truck noise. I saw black smoke in the sky. So I ran faster and faster and faster. When I got back to my wilderness area, it was all torn up by this big bulldozer who apparently was getting ready for the property to have a new house built on it. But the tree was knocked down. The babies were dead. And the mother and father and robins were flying over the top of my head, screaming and screaming in anguish. And I ran in front of that bulldozer. And I put my hands on my hips because I remembered the old Superman series on TV. And he would put his hands on his hips to get his power. And then I put one hand forward, literally touching the bulldozer, because I was not going to let that bulldozer destroy any more of the planet. And I started screaming at that man, "How can you kill my family? How can you do this?" And he jumped out of the bulldozer thinking he hit a person, and he saw a little bird, and he goes, "You're just a silly kid. Go home." And I said, "I'm not going anywhere. You can't destroy the earth." And from that day, I made an oath that I would spend my life teaching people so they would understand that these living beings are not faceless and mindless. These animals have feelings all their own, They have a consciousness all their own. They have the ability to form relationships all their own. And they live in this interconnected world of ours, where we and they are fellow travelers on this beautiful planet going through the universe at tremendous speed around the sun in this galaxy of wonderment. And that's what I've done with my life. And they really mentored me through that pain. They taught me. They forged me like a blacksmith does in the fire. So when you come out, you're honed and ready to do your craft in this world.
Thank you, Steve. Every time you share that story, it brings tears. It's you were blessed in a way of being awakened at such an early age, and what you've done with your life, the way that you have, your gift of sharing your love, sharing what you experience, and how to form relationships with not only wild animals but every living being. It's a great, great gift, and maybe you can speak a little bit more to, how we as humans can form relationships. What does it mean to form a relationship with the wild animal?
That's a really good question, because first of all, what is a wild animal, and what is a pet or a companion animal, which more describes the situation of a good animal-human relationship. It has a lot to do with respect, number one, and not just orally giving respect and intellectually giving respect, but understanding the living being that's in front of you and that it is alive, so it has all the rights that it needs to exist. It doesn't need a manifesto so humans can prove that it has some sort of benefit to humans, so we now can keep this animal alive, rather than just who cares if it becomes extinct. But these animals are extremely aware and conscious beings for what they have to do in this world. They're not aware like humans are, but we're not aware like they are. The bear knows rules or how to survive in the wilderness better than any human can. And all animals have abilities beyond what they need to survive on this planet. So to have a relationship with a wild creature, first you have to have a relationship with yourself. First you have to know who you are and go through the process of working inside and clearing out as much as you can, because these animals are not automatically going to trust anything. They're out there living in the wild, whether it's outside of our house or in the middle of a wilderness area where no human goes or very rarely goes. These animals have to worry about survival and have to worry about being eaten and have to worry about eating and have to worry about and accomplish the task of raising new babies to perpetuate the species and so forth. And so when we go out into nature and we sit there, a lot of people will want the animals to come to them. And so they sit there and in their mind, they're going, come here, come here, come here, come here, come here, come here, come here. Now, if you went to a shopping mall and you saw somebody who was attractive and you wanted to start a conversation with them, would you walk over to them and go, come here, come here, come here, come here, come here, I love you, 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 I want to touch you, I want to touch you? No, they'd be the biggest creep in the world and they'd probably call the police on you. Why do we do that and think that's all right to do that with the animals outside? If we're always pushing and always doing our human ways of domineering a landscape with our presence, these other living beings are just going to move away from us. They're not going to want to deal with our arrogance and the energy that we're putting out there, because they just will ignore us or go off and do their own business. A recent story. I have an orange cat that was a feral cat. It decided to live on the ranch. And literally, if it saw a human being, he would just run as fast as he could to get away. So I made it my long-term goal to work with him and see if I can help him out, because he's a beautiful cat. And every day, if I saw him, I would walk around him and give him as space as possible so he noticed what I was doing and was very curious and stopped running away. And And over time, I got closer to him. It took about 4 or 5 months. I can get like 6 feet from him. And then I started feeding him a little food. And within a year and a half, he was banging on the door to come in and sit with me. And it took about a year and a half, but he pretty much only likes me and one other person. Very beautiful, wonderful cat. And I have another cat, Smokey, who's very, very elderly. And I was sitting out on the porch early one morning, and it was before the sun rose, and one of the cats was in my lap. Another cat was in front of me, and another cat sat on my foot. And I realized, wait a minute, I only have two cats. So I looked down, and it was a gray fox sitting on my foot. Now, I've seen the gray fox through the windows at night, and it's actually good friends with the cats. They go to nose-to-nose together. They drink water together, and they just have this amazing relationship. And so this fox, it just took me on and just sat on my foot. He will not look at my face. He will not really acknowledge that I exist other than kind of just as the backdrop. And so that's the role I've taken with the relationship with this fox. I never reach down to touch him. I don't talk to him. I just let him be there and let the cats be there, and I'm there. Because a lot of times it just takes being who you are and not, oh, why do you always have to touch something? Why do you always, is that a selfless act or a selfish act? That we always have to touch something. We always have to reach out. Maybe we can sit there and these animals will come to us. And that's really what happens sometimes. You have to sit there in what I call a zero state. When you do meditation, if you're in a meditative practice, it's when things pretty much quiet down inside and they quiet down externally. And you kind of create this zero state, which is kind of a vacuum. And you'll notice things will start coming to you. A short story, I was up in Yosemite National Park Number of years ago, hiking on the trails, or kind of the semi-remote trails. And I just walked off the trail by about 20 foot, sat on this log, and went into a meditative zero space with my eyes open. And all of a sudden, what I thought was kind of just a little landscape started to become full of all these critters, these little mammals. So these pikas started coming out of from underneath the leaves, and the insects started coming out, and the birds started coming down to eat the insects, and there was this multitude and this incredible activity going on around me that was not happening until I settled myself into that zero state. And I was just sitting there for 15, 20 minutes watching all this go on when I heard what sounded like a father-son walking down the trail talking. And as soon as the voice was heard, all these little things skittered away and underneath everything and just camouflaged with the environment as if they didn't exist. And the father and son walked over and they saw me and with my eyes open, looking very intently, and they said, "What are you looking at?" And I just looked at them and said, "Nothing." Because at that point, there was nothing there. All the things were hidden. As soon as they walked away and it was quiet again, they came out and were alive. So most of the time, we stop ourselves from seeing what's really going on outside of us. Or we use the filters that we put in place so what we see is our projection of what we want to see out in nature. And what we need to do is sit down and just go to that zero point, go to that place of quietness inside where we can start to have relationships and start to understand what's going on around us.
Well, Steve, it's listening to your story reminds me of when you were 5 years old and running into the department store, you know, knowing that life was so rich and full, it couldn't just be this, you know, there had to be more. And
right.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
There really is so much more out there.
Mm.
And the anchor is the practice of being quiet inside. I mean, we listen to ourselves thinking all the time. We have that moderator in our head always telling us what to do. And it's not really our friend. I'm not talking about the brain that calculates and helps us. That's our friend. We need that to survive on this planet. I'm not talking about intellect. We need that to survive as a human being in today's society. But I'm talking about that constant judge that's telling you to eat the pizza and then yells at you for eating the pizza. It's not your friend. We need to, or what I found is I need to come to a real quiet place inside in order to see what's going on outside, to drop all the social norms and go to your authentic self. It is the essence of being a human being. It really is.
Can you share a story about Susie Bear and how you know how your relationship deepened? I'll just leave it at that.
Susie Bear was incredible, such an incredible teacher for me. She was born in the wild, and some poachers were chasing her mother, and I believe shot and killed her mother, and she was chased by them until she ran off a cliff and hit the ground and pretty much broke her body up quite a bit, and some backpacker saw her there, and she was a pretty small cub, and put her in, just took all of her expensive backpacking stuff and just threw it on the ground and put the bear in her backpack. You know, wonderful woman. And she backpacked this bear out into a wildlife center. And they did all sorts of operations and worked with her. And then she was given to a lady who worked with wild animals in, right outside of Los Angeles and for the motion picture industry. And Susie Bear became a famous movie star. She was in Wilderness Family and Grizzly Adams and dozens of movies. And when they shoot movies, they use different types of bears. They use one bear like that runs, another bear that fights, another bear that just sits there and hangs out and doesn't bother anybody and eats, and that was Susie Bear. So she had such a good personality that she was one that just was allowed to go and have interactions with these actors. But soon, as time went on, this lady's ranch was surrounded by suburbs, and they changed the zoning, and she couldn't take care of Susie Bear anymore, and she did not want him to go to any other person that worked animals for movies because Susie was very sensitive. And a friend of mine told me about Susie Bear, and I flew down to Los Angeles and met Susie, and we are definitely permitted by all the different appropriate agencies, and Susie Bear came up to live with us at Wildlife Associates, and she became immediately, she challenged me. The first day I went in there, she stood up on her hind legs, and she started walking toward me, making a bear noise that is not that friendly. She started going, which is an aggressive noise, which means I'm going to break you or do whatever. And I started walking toward her, yelling, no, no, no. And she kept making her noise. And on her hind legs, she was about 5'9" tall, about as tall as I am. And at the last moment, I yelled at her, and she put her face right in my face and yelled at me. And then she sat down there next to me and leaned against me. And I've concentrated and studied that day, and I realized that what she was doing is seeing if I really wanted to be in relationship with her, a bear, and that bears are very territorial, very strongly based on the planet, and they believe that where they're standing, that is theirs. And if they're going to share it with you, there has to be some sort of deep bond and relationship in order to have them share that with you. And she saw that I was going to stand my own with her, and if we had arguments, I was not going to leave. I was not going to back down. I was going to be there and be as present as she was in this relationship, and she respected that. And at that moment on, the relationship started getting deeper and deeper, and we go for daily walks in the woods, and I would sit down, and She would literally sit next to me and put her arm around my shoulders and put her head on my shoulder and kiss me in the face. She was just such a beautiful, loving being. And that relationship grew and grew, and there's just so many lessons that she's taught me about being human. And it is these animals that really teach us this relationship with all sorts of animals in our lives and help us truly understand what it's like to be a human being. And she raised me up, and I lived with her for 13 years. And every day was a sense of mystery and a sense of excitement and a sense of joy. And she did travel around to the schools for educational programs, and I still get principals seeing me at a shopping center or at a conference walking over and telling me what a difference it made for them personally and for their students. And I every so often get emails from students who are in elementary school at the time now, are out professionals in the field working as biologists and all sorts of professional capabilities that they're out there trying to save the planet in their own way. And a lot of them draw back to the experience they had with Susie Bear. And I, you know, owe my life to that beautiful, 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 beautiful being who took me and transformed me into a better human being.
Well, and I think it's extraordinary, Steve, how you will share, you know, that you'll wake up sometimes and either have a dream or Susie Bear will come to you and you'll say, aha, that's what she was teaching me. You know, the ability of these animals are teachers even beyond after they pass. They continue to be such a powerful teacher.
It's really true. A Native American elder told me, would explain a lot of stuff to me. And a lot of the time I would say, I really don't understand. And they would laugh and they say, well, that's okay. Someday you will. And I found that's the way it is with a lot of the wild teachers that I'm given the privilege to spend life with, that a lot of these lessons that we learn come to, it takes us to be at a certain place in order for them to be revealed to us. And it is really true that these animals have really taken me in their wings and teach me a lot of things and taught me the most important thing is how to be with them, how to be with these very, very, very different beings that have, you know, when they look out of their eyes, they don't see what we see. They have a different way of seeing the world around them. Some of them see ultraviolet light. Some of them can see very clearly at hundreds of yards, can read a newspaper. Some of them can't see more than a foot away from their head. Some of them see colors. Some of them don't see colors. Some of them see living or just certain colors. When they listen with their ears, what they hear is not the same as we hear. When they taste, the taste buds are different. When they smell, some of them can smell hundreds of times better than we can, thousands of times. Some of them can hardly smell at all. They all have their own input of senses and their own sense of being, of who they are and how they react to the world around them. And then we as human beings have the ability to reach out to them, and they have the ability to reach out to us. And when those two things touch, when the being of that wild animal, the being of that human inside you are yearning to communicate and yearning for a relationship and it touches, that's the magic. For me in my life, that's the magic that just gives me the goosebumps and gives me the sense of the ancient sense of what these people must have felt like who drew some of those original cave paintings 35,000 years ago in France on the walls. Well, how they felt about these animals around them, how magical they are, you know, from an ancient person's perspective. And even today, we can look at them, and we don't use the word magical now, but how incredible the reality and the senses and the consciousness of the animals and what they have to share with us. But that relationship has to be even. A lot of people have animals as quote-unquote pets, but the relationship is master and servant. Of course, they're the master. that will not work with a bear. You can't do that. A lot of people think it's a good pet if it always listens to what you tell it to do. Well, were we good pets to our parents? Not as teenagers. So we have to realize that these animals, you can form a relationship with these wild animals. And these are all non-releasable creatures that we work with here. Most of them, we save their life from being put to sleep. And you can reach out to them, and they reach out to you. And I'm sure a lot of you have stories in your lives when that's happened with your dog companion animal or cat, or even a friend of mine took care of an octopus for a number of years, and he was just blown away about the relationship he had with that octopus.
Steve, could you share a story, a healing story, about maybe one of the at-risk youth or, you know, that you've experienced at the sanctuary? Because every time I'm with you, especially when the groups of children are at the sanctuary, you know, you see transformation after transformation of these children. And maybe you could share one story about a young person who you really witnessed that transformation happen.
Yeah, what comes to mind is this one group came out from a middle school. We had about 12 kids. And these were kids that were on the edge of being kicked out of school, possibly being drawn into the, some of them were actually even drawn into the probation system. And they, at this point in their life, could make either the right decision or wrong decision. And that wrong decision would spell it just the disastrous way of living for these kids, going in and out of the jail system or being homeless or whatever. And so there's this one kid who was like 6'2" tall, and for eighth graders, that's a pretty big kid. And none of the other kids were getting within 6 feet of him. If he walked through a group of kids, they would just like move around him, like it was this parting of the seas. And I walked over to one of the teachers, and I said, "What's the story with the tall boy over here?" And she said, "Well, he's been so abused by his father and mother, who almost on a daily basis will beat him up and tell him he's worthless." And his father would say, "Until you go to jail, you're not a man." And just not a good way to be raised. And so I went over. I just had a feeling that my horse, Little Thunder, could help. Little Thunder is a golden and white paint horse. Beautiful, beautiful creature. And I noticed that he had a talent. His talent was to find one of the most hurt and damaged kids of the group, each group that I bring out, and walk over to them and try to elicit some sort of relationship with them. And so he knew what to do. He was a healer and is a healer. He's still here, and he knows what to do. And so I went out and put on his lead and brought him out and walked over to this boy, and I did not want him to say no, so I reached over and said, "Hold this quick, I got to tie my shoes, hold this quick." So he just held it out of response, and I went down and pretended I was tying my shoes, even though I was wearing cowboy boots. And I stood back up, and he looked at me, and he goes, "Why is the horse looking at me?" I said, "The horse likes you." "No, he doesn't." I said, "Well, start walking, see what happens." "Why is the horse following me?" I said, "He likes you." "No, he doesn't." I said, "Stop, see what happens." "Why did the horse stop?" Well, this went on and on and on, and we have this road that goes around the front of the education center. It's like the size of a football field. And we're three-quarters of the way around going toward the group of kids when this tall, fierce-looking young man turned to me with tears started coming down his eyes, and he goes, "I think I'm going to cry." And I said, "Why?" And Thunder buried his head in this kid's chest. And he gave Thunder a big hug, and he started crying, and he looked at me and he said, "I've never been loved before." Can you imagine that? Here's this eighth grader who's never been loved before. How does that happen? I mean, my mother, when I was being raised, would hug me 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times a day and smile and feed me and always tell me what a wonderful person I was going to be. And this little boy, a tall boy, never been loved before. And then how did Thunder do that? Because that's what he loves to do. He loves to love me. He loves to break down those bonds, the boundaries, and loves to create bonds with people. That's what he really found his place here. And we don't know what happened to that boy. He ended up moving up to the Pacific Northwest because the mother had to run away from the husband. And so we don't know what happened in that case. But we do know on that day something very powerful happened because of one of our wild teachers. And it affected me, too. As much as it affected that kid, it changed me.
Hmm. Yeah, Steve, this is Rahul. It's just touching to me, too, to hear that story. Thanks so much for sharing it. So we're at the time in the call where we like to open it up for folks on the call who have questions for you. So if you've got a question for Steve or just a reflection you'd like to share, press star 6 to get in the queue. And in the meantime, I know that Anne has many more questions. So we'll just continue with Anne's flow. And as questions come in, I will pop in and allow those to flow through. And actually, there is one that just popped in. So maybe we'll go there. And then, Anne, I can go back to you.
Okay.
Okay. Here we go.
Hey, Steve. It's Annette. Good morning.
Morning.
The question that I have for you that I have been wondering for a very long time is I would love to know either an experience or a story when something that you have learned from an animal has impacted your ability to relate to a specific person. How has it impacted your ability to relate, the lessons that the animals have taught you, your ability to relate to other humans?
The first thing that comes to mind. Is very important. It's not a particular person, but it has helped me in all my whole consciousness. It has shifted the way I am being a human being. Was with Mingo the coyote. Mingo passed away about 15 years ago, and he was about 19, 20, almost 20 years old, which is extremely old for a coyote. They normally in the wild live 5, 6, 7 years because it's a tough life out there. So he lived a really long time with me, and he was like my son. And he was very old, and he could hardly walk around without a lot of pain, and so I knew it was time for him to be released back to where he came from. And I called the veterinarian up, and the veterinarian was going to come over the next day at a certain time, And I had a dream that I'd walked Mingo to the certain place in the sanctuary where he lay down, and that's where he wanted to leave his body. So before the veterinarian got there, about an hour or so before, I leashed up Mingo the coyote, and he pulled me, literally, walking to that exact same spot that was in my dream, and he laid there in the exact same way he did in my dream. And this wasn't the first time that's happened, so I was just really, really honored that and really respected that and sat there and petted him and told him how much I loved him and how many people he's changed because of him going into the schools and doing educational programs and prayed that wherever that being goes that's gone when an animal dies, when that leaves this coyote, take him to the highest realm possible because he deserved being there for the kindness he showed me and for all the hundreds of thousands of kids that he taught about himself and wild animals and why we should protect and honor and protect all these creatures that live on our planet. Then the veterinarian came and we gave him some sedative, and all of a sudden, all these cows, one of the neighbors had some cows in our field, these like 30, 40 cows, like stampeded from one part of the 120-acre ranch over to where we heard the noise coming. And they ran over, and we were at the perimeter fence of the sanctuary, and they were within inches of Mingo the coyote. And they all came over and sniffed, and were sniffing him and sniffing him. And all of a sudden, we gave him the shot to put him asleep. And I always see when the animal passes away, this is just me, I always see something like a heat wave on top of the animal, kind of like I see it myself as maybe the soul or whatever that life force is leaving the body. And then I said, Mingo, don't worry about me. I'm okay. You just go where you're supposed to go. I'll be fine. And it was the first time I ever really said that in a very selfless way, because I really meant it, that you go, you be who you are. You can go where you're supposed to go, and I'll be fine here. Yes, I'll miss you, but I'll be just fine. You've done what you need to do on this planet, and thank you. And all of a sudden, my body started shaking, and I felt these words in my head and said, you are the coyote. And I realized what I was being told is, I always thought that when you're selfless, you're empty. And that being selfless was, you know, being empty and just letting all of it go, but it's not true. When you become selfless and do a selfless act, you are filled with grace and joy and essence. Because that voice that said, you are now the coyote, I felt that to mean it. Now that I've made my first act of selflessness or whatever, just really was powerful, that the coyote came into me and I became closer to him ever before in ways I never imagined. And so every person in every situation I've been in has been affected from that, because I realized the more I give in relationship, whether it's human or animal or tree or grass or the breath I take, the more I experience from that, and the more I can see the beauty of life. And so being selfless is not being empty and being the thing that people throw darts at and you just walk around with pain. The opposite is true. It is the ultimate of joy, the ultimate of experiencing who you are as a human being. And I owe that all to Mingo the coyote. And I owe that all to those two robins that set me on my path. And I owe that all to my ancestors who brought me to the place I am today.
Wow. What a beautiful insight to have arisen from those experiences. Steve, I have a question for you that's related to what you just shared and something you shared earlier on the call around this process of listening to animals. And I'm curious of how that connection was made for you between this idea of listening to animals and listening to yourself, or you know, getting to that sort of meditative zero state that you talked about. Can you share a little bit about how that, how those two things sort of came together for you in your journey?
Yes, it wasn't intentional that they would go together. I was looking for, all throughout elementary, middle, and high school, I was looking around the corners and looking for the sense of reality in places that people normally don't look. And some of my friends came back from starting this new meditation practice. And this is when I was in college, back in late 72, early 73. And started to realize that this is maybe something that's missing is this practice of inner working on the inside so I can become clearer. And they came back and told me about this meditation from this young man from India whose name was Prem Rawat. And so in 1973, I started to do the meditation practice. And I've been doing the practice ever since. And some sort of contemplative, meditative practice is extremely important for us as human beings, no matter what it is. This works for me. This path works for me and affects me. And you need to find what affects you and what works with you and stick with it. Not be the McDonald's of, go to the McDonald's of a meditation, and every week it's a different thing, and just find something that works and for you and does it, whatever it is that makes your mind stop, and you have a place of quietness to go to. Because number one, it's incredible for mental health. Number two, it's incredible that you a way to clear yourself out so you can be there in the present state in a relationship. With my wolf, when I had when Cheyenne was alive, she really helped me with the meditative mindfulness practice, because if I was in this wolf's enclosure and I started to think about something else, immediately, within seconds, that wolf knew I was not 100% with her, and she would lift up her lip and start growling at me, telling me, you are here with me now, you be here. Don't think about other things, don't be outside this thing, be with the magic that's taking place with me and you at this moment. And that lesson has carried me over, because with her, she was physically telling me, meditate, be still, because meditation is not always with your eyes closed. Meditation is not always with your eyes closed, being remote from humans and remote from everything. Even though that's, for me, that's an important part of it, but a lot of it has to do with what happens when your eyes are open and you're walking around in this world. Who are you? Are you out for yourself? Are you becoming a martyr? Who are you? Are you judging everything by standards that you're not even sure of? Maybe you can just be who you are and not have to worry and change that self-narrative. Because we all have the self-narrative about who we are. But like any story, we can change it. We have the power of the pen, which is our consciousness. We have the power of rewriting our own story, which is inner work. And it's just as important as outer work. And it really helps clear you up, because when you're cleared up inside, these animals tend to want to look at you, and they're attracted to you. When I go out into a field and I sit there, I go to that zero point, because I notice then I can see these animals are less worried about who I am and less concerned about me being a predator rather than just part of the landscape. And even with human beings, it helps, because people aren't threatened. People relax. People want to come over and talk to me, because I'm not attacking them on an internal level and having all this mind going on and all this activity that could be silent. So I would say that silence inside is very important with any relationship, whether it be animals, humans, or even the relationship with the air.
Mm. Thank you so much for sharing that, Steve. For those on the call, if you've got a question or a comment you'd like to share, press *6 to get in that queue. And I certainly have more questions, but I'm going to turn it back over to Anne to continue while we're waiting for your questions to come up. So, Anne, please continue.
Great, thank you. Two things, Steve, quote that I wanted to make sure we include in this conversation. And one, I'd just love for you to share with everyone how you introduce an animal into the sanctuary. I think that's very important. And then the second question would be around these new science standards that are being brought into the California system, and how you are working to collaborate and create curriculum and a different way of teaching to the children.
And what was the first question again?
The first question is how you introduce an animal to the sanctuary.
It's very important that we honor and respect these creatures that for no fault of their own have been injured and damaged or born in captivity, and all these things happen so these animals cannot survive on their own in the wild. So when they come to us, I want to give them all the respect in the world, and I want to somehow let them know that where they are. And, of course, they're not understanding my words. I don't sit there and have these psychic discussions with these animals, because I don't think they know English, but they do understand intent. and they do understand what you're paying attention to. So your intent and your attention, they're very, very aware of. And so when you go to a deep place inside and talk to them, they pick up the intent. They realize that something's going on. And so for me, I have this little ritual I do where I'll sit with the animal and I'll talk to the animal. Like the latest one, it would be North American porcupine. And I sat down in front of her and I said, "Welcome to the wildlife sanctuary. I'm Steve and I'm going to be your friend, and all these humans here really are going to love you and care for you and feed you as much as we can, and whenever you need medical treatment, we'll do whatever we can to make you healthy and give you a long and happy life. And all I ask is that you help us in teaching the human beings to be better human beings so we can protect the earth and protect and honor all creatures in the wild. And all I need from you is, and please don't hurt us. Be kind to us, because all we want to do is help you and protect you and give you a happy life while you're here at the sanctuary." And it's just an honoring that I do to set my intention. So every time I see that beautiful creature, this is a promise that I gave them. And this is a promise that I will spend my life making sure that I can meet. And this is the promise that all of us here at the sanctuary, staff and volunteers, say, that we're here to honor, respect, and to enrich the lives of these animals, whatever that takes. And these wonderful staff are here caring for the animals. They're here hours and hours and hours after they should be here, working with behavioral enrichment items and toys and all sorts of things that the animals can play with and things that really add happiness to their existence. And so I have just a wonderful, wonderful group of people here to work with these animals. And I'm really excited about us going into the schools. We reach over 300 schools a year in Northern California. And we're getting a jump start on the new next generation science standards in the schools. We have a new vocabulary for the kids, new programs we're developing to teach them science in a way that they're excited about it, they have interest in it. Because science is extremely important for the future of these kids, economic future, social future, and even social justice. That these kids, if they don't learn science and don't get excited about it, their wage earning power is going to be a lot lower. But science in itself is not the answer to our problems. It's also empathy and caring and understanding. Because with empathy and caring and understanding and no science, we'll do well-intentioned damage to the earth. If we just have science without empathy and caring, the same thing will happen. So we need the combination of having a real human being doing real science and understanding the implications and caring about all living things and empathy for all life. And that's that whole big circle that we're bringing into existence in the schools, because at a young age, if this is integrated into who you are as a young person, it goes into long-term memory and actually becomes who you are as an adult. And so we're working toward helping the society become more literate, science literate, and an empathic society at the same time.
Mm. We do have a question in the queue, Steve, but I wanted to ask a question myself that sort of latched on to what you just shared. There was a teacher that Nipun recently met when he was in India who said, you know, that the 18th century gave rights to man and the 19th century gave rights to slaves and the 20th century gave rights to women, and now the 21st century will give rights to animals. I was wondering what your thoughts are around that concept and just how you feel that concept relates to, you know, what seems to be the predominant culture most of the world over around not respecting animals, animal consumption, things of that sort. So if you could just you know, share some of your thoughts around animal rights and some of the some of the transformations that have happened in your life around the question of what it means to fully respect those animals when we're in this, a culture that's a predominantly animal-consuming culture, or at least one that doesn't even recognize them as full beings.
That's a big one. That's a real big one, because you're right. They don't respect them as beings. There was a event that I was invited to up at the state capitol. The Senate Committee on Natural Resources and Wildlife, I think this was in the 80s or early 90s, invited me there with Susie Bear, because we were trying to stop the hounds hunting of bear in California, which is where if you pay, you can sit home and you pay these people with these dogs to go tree a bear, and then they call you on the cell phone, and then you drive up there or whatever, go to the bottom of the tree, you know, a day or so later, and shoot and kill the bear. Just horrendous, horrendous activity. So I was more than happy to help with that. And I was listening to some of the people with the bear hunters saying that when they bow hunt the bear and they shoot the bear doesn't feel pain. And I realized at that point that they had to believe that, because I do think they do believe that, because if they really didn't, if they came to the realization how much pain and suffering they're causing that animal, I don't think they can live with themselves. So they had this false story they kept telling themselves. And I explained to the state Senate committee that I stepped on Susie Bear's foot once by accident. She knocked me down on my butt, and because she felt it. And if she can feel me stepping on her foot, she can definitely feel a stick with a steel tip on it going into her body and puncturing her lungs. She would feel as much, if not more, pain than we would, and fear and anxiety than we would at that time. And I think that empathy is very important, but you can't really teach empathy. You can nurture empathy. You can foster empathy. But that at a certain point, the person has to carry that with them and start to see what that feeling is, to understand that the pain of others. And empathy is an extremely important part of being a human being, and also forming relationships with others. How can you have a relationship with an other unless you are empathic and realize if you say something, how it's going to affect them. If you do something, how it's going to affect them on a feeling basis. Just a more empathic person has a better relationship with humans and animals around them. So it's a very, very hard thing to discuss, because you have all these gazillions of chickens and cattle, and all these animals are being eaten by human beings, and you have all this suffering going on around it. And I sure hope it's true that this is the century where we'll realize that animals have rights. As I mentioned before, they have a right to live just because they're alive. You don't, they don't need any other explanation. Unfortunately, this is the way I think, and not the majority of the human beings. And that we can't really let this turn us bitter. That, yes, there's a lot of suffering going on, but we can't let it affect us in a bitter way. We can't even, in my way I look at it, we can't even let it make us angry. We can, like when I saw those birds dead, my brother and sisters, those robins dead on the ground in a lot in my backyard. I never felt mad and angry and mean. I never wanted to hurt that man. I just wanted him to understand. I lectured with Julia Butterfly once, and she's the young lady that spent quite a number of months or a year or so up in the redwood tree so they wouldn't cut it down. And she told me once that she would sit and stand outside of this parking area and listen to these people cut the trees down. And as the trees fall, they make this like screaming noise. and she would literally feel these huge redwood trees screaming as they would die and smash into the ground. And I said, why did you stay there all day and listen to this? Why didn't you just leave? And she said that she really believed that unless you can feel the depths of despair, you can't feel the heights and the beauty of love in your life. And that taught me, this young lady taught me, that we these feelings that we have as human beings, we should not stop them and let them plug up, even if it's where we're feeling pain, because that's part of human existence. It's really part of human existence, and I really do believe now that unless you do let yourself go to these depths, you'll never go to these heights. Just don't dwell there. It's not a fun place to be.
Sure, sure. I think Bumblebee has a question, and we probably have time for maybe a couple more, so if anyone wants to get in a question, press star 6 to get in the queue, and we'll go to Bumblebee's question.
Thank you, Rahul. Good morning, Steve. This is Pallavi.
Good morning.
I'm actually speechless at the moment with what you just shared about going to the depths of despair to reach the heights of love. I'm having to kind of concentrate to take myself back to my question, which was, you know, a little bit earlier you talked about being in the zero state. And, you know, I can feel your presence on the phone. I've been to the wildlife sanctuary once. I've felt your presence there. And, you know, you reach this place of immense presence. And I was curious to know, you know, how you have dealt with crisis in your life. You know, I'm wondering, you know, it's probably been a process for you to keep coming back inward. Or, you know, I'm just curious as to, you know, if you could share something about that, how you learned to deal with crisis.
Definitely. And the first thing that popped in my head is Parkinson's. And the reason I would mention Parkinson's is it's something that everybody expects they're going to be able to get up and walk and pick something up with their hand and dial the phone and type something, that these are things that we just tell our body to do and the body serves us. But with Parkinson's, the mind is telling the body to do other things. Like instead of picking up the pen and writing with it, the hand shakes or the fingers don't work to pick up the pen. And there's many times I can't type in front of the computer. Sometimes it's very difficult for me to walk 20, 30 feet. And then all of a sudden the next moment I'm okay at walking. And then next moment it feels like my legs are weigh 1,000 pounds each, and they're kind of stuck to the ground. And it's very unpredictable when these things happen. And sometimes, like Ann mentioned in the beginning, all I can do is sit there and breathe, because at certain times, even my automatic breath stops being automatic, and I have to manually sit there, concentrate on breathing in and out and in and out. And I would say that's a bit of a crisis more than having to fundraise more than my car broke down on the freeway. What am I going to do?
Yes.
This is a definite crisis. And what I've learned is it's part of impermanence, and it's a real lesson in front of my face that nothing is permanent. Nothing is going to stay the same. Everything goes through constant changes. And that we can't be really attached to these outward changes, because it's just a different part of being a human being. And having Parkinson's really brings people to that point where they just have to be grateful that they're alive. And when all I can do but sit there and breathe, I sit there and go, well, I can... This is part of my practice. This is part of my way to just follow the breath. And the mind, I find it with Parkinson's, the mind does work slower inside my head, which helps me in the contemplative ways. It's still painful. It's still frustrating at times. But I have that anchor, that practice that I've been doing for over 40 years of meditation, that anchor to be with that discomfort and just turn it into part of existence. Does that help at all?
Yes. Thank you.
Because we're human beings. We all go through periods of
time. Thank you.
Does that help?
Yes.
Okay. Steve, we're getting towards the end of our call, and one thing that it's my privilege to do as the host is to ask you how we as a community can be of some service to you. What can we do to make ourselves available and be of service in your work?
Wow, that's nice. Here I am. I just turned 60. I have Parkinson's. So there's no way of telling how much longer I can teach. And teaching is what I'm here to do on this planet. And I need to share all these lessons that have been given to me by these animals. I think there's so much that needs to be given to people, because people tell me after some of these lessons how much it's really affected them, so I really need to do this. It's part of who I am. So if everybody on this call and even people that you meet can send me an email on what they think they would, what type of class they would like to take, what type of seminar, weekend, or a couple hour long, or what they would like to learn and what I can teach, I can get an idea of what's needed out there and maybe start filling some of these needs and holding some classes and teaching as many people as I can about these this amazing relationship that we can have with the world around us. And remember,
sure,
it takes me a while to respond because I can't always type, so be patient.
Okay, so perhaps we could send your email out to the callers, or Anne, if you would maybe be open, we could maybe direct those emails to you. And I know you see Steve fairly regularly, but we'll figure that out, and we'll definitely
absolutely.
We'll figure out. We'll get people's comments and aspirations on what they want to learn to you, Steve. So we've come to the end of our time, and we like to end the call in a similar way that we began, which is with a moment of silence. But this time it's a moment of silence in gratitude for Steve's presence and all the conditions that have come together to allow us to be in a space of sharing this time and really gaining these insights from this remarkable journey that Steve has been on. So we'll do a moment of silence, and then I will actually unmute everyone after that moment of silence and gratitude, and we'll have an opportunity to vocally express our thanks and gratitude to Steve. So just 1 minute of silence and gratitude.